When Chazal taught Megillas Esther, again, this is a shir that I'm re-recording. Unfortunately, the microphone didn't work during the shir I just gave to the boys, so it's a little quieter. When Chazal spoke about Megillas Esther and they taught the Talmidim, they felt that there were hidden, concealed messages that had to be tweaked out by quoting parallel psukim in Tanakh that evoked some of these messages, or that teased out some of these messages. And these psukim that Chazal introduced Megillas Esther with are listed in Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Aleph, also in the introduction to Echa Rabasi. I have a shir on Yutar, a series of shir. I'm going through some of these preambles or introductions. Anyway, when Rev Berechia taught Megillas Esther, he introduced it with the following pasuk in Yeshaya Mem Aleph. Mi pa'al vi'asa, who created human history, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Kare Hadaros Mirosh. He announced various generations before history was launched. Namely, there were certain generations, certain people within each generation that introduced new modes of human behavior, new modalities, new aspects to the human experience. And Hashem announced these ahead of time. And the Medrash in Esther Rabbah, in the Psicha, talks about who introduced some of these ideas. Cain introduced murder. Avraham introduced bris milah. Yitzchak introduced sacrifice. Yosef introduced piety. And on and on and on. Towards the end of the list, Achashverosh rosh lamochrim, Haman rosh lakonim. Achashverosh introduced selling, and Haman introduced buying. That's strange. No one bought or sold before Achashverosh and Haman. What does this medrash mean? Why did Rebbe Rechia quote this pasuk? Why did he quote this list and include Haman and Achashverosh? So we have to take a few steps back and recognize the accumulation of money and wealth that took place in the Persian Empire. And it's evident when you look at the parties and you see the painstaking detail, the marble, the gold, the silver, the chalices, the cups, the upholstery, the floors, the harosos, yikar teferes kedulasovis, rov ashro. Obviously, this is a party celebrating wealth and opulence and aggregation of wealth. There are two or three factors that lead to the aggregation of wealth, and then there's one social factor that creates a disproportionate admiration for wealth. What happens? So you have two events, two political phenomena colluding to create concentration of wealth. Number one, you have multi-regional empires spanning not just local areas. When you have a local empire, there's a natural cap or natural limit to how much wealth you can aggregate. When you span 127 provinces, you're able to collect more wealth than you would otherwise. Second of all, you don't just have accumulated wealth because of the geography, but because you have very, very quick succession from one multi-regional empire to another. Namely, empires rise and fall, and the famous phrase, the curse of the third generation. First generation, not just at a macro level, but at a micro level, amasses wealth. The second generation enjoys the wealth, and the third generation squanders the wealth. Even though the second generation uses it, it preserves it, the third generation. And this has been studied extensively. It's very hard for multi-generational wealth to be sustained. And it's true at a micro level with human beings and families, and it's true at a macro level with empires. But what you had at this period is you had quick successions between empires. And each empire inherited the wealth from the previous empire. So Am Yisrael accumulated huge, huge, vast amounts of wealth during their dynasty in the first Beis HaMikdash era. But then when Assyria and Ashur plundered the 10 tribes, they took much of that wealth to Assyria. And then Babylon upseated or unseated Assyria. So Nebuchadnezzar acquired all that wealth. And then very quickly, the Persian and Median Empire. So Parasomadai has now received wealth that's been aggregated by four different dominant world empires, and it increases its own coffers because it spreads its reach and its taxing tentacles across 127 regions. So all of a sudden in Shushan, there's a lot of wealth, there's a lot of money. Not only is there a lot of wealth, but there's a culture that celebrates money. Why? Shushan was a very multicultural society. Foreigners were welcome. Ethnicities were preserved. No one was meant to feel like an outsider. No one was meant to conform to any larger local customs. V'hashtiach hadas ein ones. Lasel sl'ish v'ish kirtzono. Everyone could eat and drink as they chose. Chazal say that some of the guests came from countries where they ate before they drank, and some of the guests came from countries where they drank before they ate. And each was allowed to maintain their custom, which to us, in the modern world, the liberal world, seems very normal. You take it for granted. But in the ancient world of monarchs, when you feasted at his table, you followed protocol. You didn't drink before he or she drank. You didn't eat before they ate. You ate what they were served to you. You ate how they ate. It was very rigid, very regimented, very much protocol. And here it's very loose and liberal and accommodating. So in this pluralistic society, Medina Medina Kichtava V'am V'am Kilshono, there is no one universal objective value that people rally around because everyone's got their own eating style and their own dress and their own language and their own culture. So when you have a multicultural world, there's only one universal value that rises to the top. That's, of course, the value of money because money is universal. So in the culture of Persia, you didn't just have a lot of money, but you had a culture which celebrated money and celebrated wealth and heralded people because they were affluent and because they were rich. That's what happened in Persia, and that's why Rebbe Rechia spoke of Achashverosh as Rosh Lamochrim and Haman as Rosh Lakonim. Now, what are the consequences of this? What are the moral consequences? There are three moral consequences, and Esther and Mordechai have to defend humanity against these moral consequences, because the story of the Megillah isn't just the story of the Jewish people saving their soul, saving themselves, but stepping into this battle against these large empires that produce, or at least introduce, threaten humanity with decayed moral values, and we have to redirect these values and defend humanity against these toxic, dangerous values. Number one, you have unequal allocation of wealth. Anytime there's an aggregation of wealth, it's hard for humanity to distribute it equally. It happened about 120 years ago during the Gilded Age of the railroads and transportation and communication, where a select few controlled a large percentage of the finances or the assets, and it's happening again today because of the internet revolution, because of a couple other factors. You have a volatile situation where a small percentage of humanity controls a large disproportionate degree of assets, and it's a combustible situation, a situation that can't be sustained, but it's also morally toxic. And you see this with Achashverosh. Achashverosh's parties, rollicking parties, 180 days, someone had to foot the bill. Someone had to pay for those parties. The money doesn't come from nowhere. Money doesn't grow in trees. While people were partying it up in the cosmopolitan banquet halls of Shushan, there were millions and millions of peasants and villagers and farmers across the 127 provinces who were being taxed through the nose. Gemara says why she called Achashverosh, Shakol Nasim Rashim B'yamav. Everyone became poor because he bled them dry. And you have people that are living off of the hard work and diligence of other people. Sometimes when I go to European palaces and I see the opulence and the wealth and the affluence and the greed, and you just realize how these immoral, degenerate monarchs bled their countries dry for centuries. In some cases, I believe they sunk their countries because I think there are some countries that are still trying to recover from that parasitical living off of other people just to satisfy your own greed and your own wealth. And that's part of the morally troubling story of Megillas Esther. And in part, Esther and Mordechai are trying to defend against that. So when Esther is appointed queen in Perek Beis, and Achashverosh conducts a party for her, this is the third party in Megillas Esther, Vayas HaMelech Mishteh Gadol L'chol Sarav Avodav, Perek Beis Pasuk Yudches, Es Mishteh Esther, V'Hanachah LaMedina Al-Sasa, there's tax relief. Vayitain Maseis Kiyat HaMelech, and provisions and food and gifts are sent out to all the provinces. So Esther helps the moral recovery of Shushan. And then sadly, when Esther and Mordechai recede from the scene after Megillas Esther is concluded, Vayasim HaMelech Perek Yud Achashverosh Mas Al Haaretz V'i Hayam. Achashverosh now is taxing people again because he has to return to his hedonistic, self-serving, selfish, greedy ways. So he has to tax people again. So part of the problem in Shushan is the unequal distribution of wealth and the discriminatory policies where a select few get to party it up for 180 days while people are working tooth and nail in the fields across the provinces just to support and just to pay their taxes on time and not to be jailed. Second of all, you create a society that becomes very transactional, in which everything has a price and everything is gauged in terms of price. So Haman knows that he can pay 10,000 shkalim for genocide, And he describes it to Achashverosh, Yeshnu Amechad Mefosar Umefarad Bein Ha'amim, V'lamelech Ein Shovel Hanicham. It's not worth your while. It's not in your best interest financially. And when you create a society that's transactional, you objectify people and you... Everything is termed financially and commercially in value, and you lose sight of identity that can't be captured or quantified in value. And this is a city in which everything can be quantified in value, and everything has a price, including genocide. And Haman presents it to Achashverosh, and even in his own mind, when he returns home, having been invited to Esther's party, he says, V'chol ze inenu shoveli. This is not worth anything to me. All my pride and accomplishments. So in its own mind, he's trying to put value on life, experience, promotion, career, whatever. Not everything could be evaluated. And let's think a little bit about our world, and what are the ill effects of capitalism? What's happened to our society a few generations after capitalism has dominated the world economy? And Baruch Hashem, it's delivered prosperity and it's delivered welfare to so many, and it's liberated economies and it's empowered human imagination and human creativity. But we tend to become very transactional, and we define things with the consumer price index and consumer confidence. And Rav Aaron was appalled by referring to ourselves as consumers. We're not consumers, we're producers. He found that whole concept appalling. And of course, there are very extreme versions of transactionalizing experiences, with chas v'shalom, situations where females are objectified and transactions that are meant to be personal and dignified are transactionalized. But not just on those far margins of society, but have we become too transactional? Do we view community? Do we view membership in shuls? Do we view identity? Do we view allegiance? And do we view it through the lenses of money and how much money people are asking for us and from us in schools? And this should be relationships and experiences and contexts in which money shouldn't enter the conversation. Because once it does, it creates a transactional lens through which we view these experiences that should have meaning far more impactful than transactionalism. And the third moral fallout, not just the unequal distribution of wealth and not just the culture of transactionalism, but a culture of acquisition creates a culture of desire and appetite. And at a certain point, when you max out financially to serve your appetite for more, you look for honor and tribute and fame and glory. And you become not just greedy, but you become egomaniacal, megalomaniacal. And you see this in Haman. Haman is so wealthy, doesn't have a need for any money. And once he maxes out financially, it's his honor. And he's affronted by Mordechai. This is so sad. The entire kingdom bows to Haman. No one is exempt from Haman's authority. One little old Jew from Yerushalayim refuses to bow. Walk away. Turn your face away. Ignore him. He's just a Jew. There's plenty of other people who are bowing to you. And Haman could have averted this entire episode, his entire death, and his entire collapse. But he can't, because pride sets in. And then later, when he returns from the party with Esther, and he sees Mordechai, holds in his Chevrolet, so he runs home, and he's agitated, and he builds the Eitz Gevoach HaMishim Amba, and that becomes his own gallows. And he runs to the king in the middle of the night, or in the morning, and he disturbs the king, and just chasing pride, chasing glory, and he entraps himself again and again. You just see the sadness and the tragedy of running after your ego and running after honor and running after pride. And the two are connected. In a society of acquisition and money and competition and rivalry, remember about 30 years ago during the Enron scandal, there were some high-profile energy companies in Houston. And there were scandals in which some of the executives were jailed for misappropriating funds. And they interviewed some of these jailed executives and said, look, you had hundreds of millions of dollars you could sustain your life and the life of your children and grandchildren, and yet you risked it all on you. You surrendered your freedom just for another couple million. And one of the executives says, it wasn't about what I needed. It's that other people had more than me, and I had to outpace them and outcompete with them. And it was just so sad to me to see people who had all the resources you could ever want chasing their own pride and their own desire to surpass other people. And you see this in Megillas Esther, and you see Haman chasing his ego and chasing his appetite for more. And these are the three moral freefalls of a society in which wealth is aggregated and accumulated and wealth is worshipped. And Mordechai and Esther are coming to try to relieve some of that. And that's why when Esther is nominated, her party leads to tax relief. And that's why in the end of Megillas Esther, the mitzvos hayom are geared towards using money for more productive, selfless purposes. Matanos levyonim, mishloach manos asherehu. And that's why we give our shkalim before Haman shkalim. It's a game. We're trying to precede Haman shkalim, but our shkalim are meant to be delivered to the public coffer, or to the Beis HaMikdash, for proper rituals and ceremonies, not for selfish, greedy hedonism. And that's why the money ultimately gets redirected, not just morally, but historically, because the money gets redirected. Beis Haman is delivered to Mordechai and Esther, and that money that Haman had aggregated, that money ultimately makes its way back to Yerushalayim to help build the Beis HaMikdash. So there's an economical, a financial story being told in Megillas Esther, and it's one of how you calibrate, because this is the first time the world had accumulated such wealth, and they didn't know, frankly, what to do with it. And part of the struggle of Megillas Esther is not just to save the Jewish people from annihilation, but to teach the world a more balanced way to deal with wealth and with the accumulation of wealth.